Today on the 21st show, we're marking International Holocaust Remembrance Day, which falls on Friday this year. We're doing so by listening to the survival story of the Gingold family, as told by Bill. He's a retired family physician living in central Illinois, but he was born into Nazi-occupied Poland.
When we were brought back to the Warsaw Ghetto, we were put into one room with eight people, no mattresses, no bathroom, no heat, no light.
Bill, along with his father, mother, and older brother, tried three times to escape the Nazis, and while they eventually did, it would be almost a decade before their journey brought them to America. I'm Brian Mackey, the Gingold Family Survival Story, coming up today on The 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Tomorrow is International Holocaust Remembrance Day. During the Second World War, Nazi Germany slaughtered more than 6 million people who were Jewish, and also Romani, disabled, gay, and a number of other ethnic, religious, and political minorities. Although it happened in Europe, anti-immigrant sentiment in the U.S. cost lives. Here's filmmaker Ken Burns in an interview last year with CBS as he promoted his documentary series, The U.S. and the Holocaust.
We did not play a role in the murder of the Jews. We just did not do enough as a good people to get the people on the edge of this cataclysm out. And that is on us, and will forever be on us.
Among the small number of Holocaust survivors who did make it to America's shores is Bill Gingold of Urbana. We're going to spend our entire program today hearing about his journey, along with his mom, dad, and brother, from the Warsaw Ghetto to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where he spent his teenage years. We first broadcast this conversation last year in September. As ever, we appreciate hearing what you thought of the show and your suggestions for future guests or topics. Email us. The address is talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. One other note, I have to warn you, some of the details of life under Nazi occupation may not be suitable for listeners of all ages. Okay, here now is my conversation with Bill Gingold. Dr. Gingold, welcome to the 21st Show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
I'd like to begin with the beginning of the Second World War in 1939. Poland falls to Nazi Germany. The country's Jewish population is forced to live in a section of Warsaw that was about 1.3 square miles. And by way of comparison, Urbana, Illinois is 11.5 square miles, so a much smaller area. At its height, this area was home to 400,000 people. You were born in September 1939. So I imagine you don't have direct memories, but tell us, what was Warsaw like at that time?
I was born September 20th, 1939. One day after I was born, the hospital that I was in was bombed. And shortly after that, about 7 days later, the rest of Warsaw was bombed, and the Nazi regime took over pretty much Poland. So we were kind of fortunate in that my father kind of anticipated some of the potential issues coming up with the war. And shortly after I was born, he took my mother and me out of the hospital. And he was bright enough to say, we better try to get out of Warsaw as soon as possible with thousands upon thousands of other people that wanted to get out of Warsaw. So basically, while I was an infant, one day old, my parents, my mother's name was Leah, my dad's name was Duvid, and we also had, I had an aunt and an uncle. My aunt was 16 years of age at that time. My uncle was about 21. So that was our immediate family as we were trying to escape Warsaw, Poland. And as we were leaving Warsaw with thousands upon thousands of other people, both Jewish people as well as Polish people and others, on the roads, the planes would fly over the people trying to flee and basically shoot them. So anyone that wasn't bright enough to get off the road was basically killed as they were fleeing Warsaw. My parents were pretty gutsy, and they dived into the gullies and into the woods. So they were saved from that initial bombardment from the Nazi planes. Unfortunately, as they moved towards the Eastern Front or the Russian sector, at that time, there was an armistice agreement between the Germans and the Russians not to kill each other or basically enter into aggression. It was a non-aggression treaty. So when we arrived close to the Russian military, they put us on trucks, and because the non-aggression treaty was in effect, they put us on German trucks, and the German trucks took us back to Warsaw. So that was our first initial effort to escape Warsaw. And of course, where they put us at that point in time was a place called Warsaw Ghetto.
Yes.
Which was, you know, the space that you briefly described. It was about 2.5% of the total geographic area of Warsaw.
What was your family life like at the time? What sort of space did you have to
live
in?
Okay. When we were brought back to the Warsaw Ghetto, we were put into one room with eight people, no mattresses, no bathroom, no heat, no light. We had to share. It was kind of a ghetto environment of a rundown apartment buildings, if you will, multi-story apartments. So people had to share whatever utilities were available, the bathrooms, and et cetera. So the living was not ideal, to say the least.
To say the least. No.
Yeah. And of course, I was a baby at that time, so that brought some additional challenges, not only to the Gingolds, but to other families that had children. And one of the things I want to stress here is that one of the cardinal principles that occurred, and I think it's been historically that way with the Jewish people, is that protection, to whatever extent possible, of their children is priority number one. They'll do anything to protect their children.
How did you survive? What did you eat? How did you get food?
Okay. Well, there were food lines. Initially, the ghetto was a little open, so there was some communication from the outside to the inside. There was a lot of smuggling, exchange of goods for food, etc. There were some soup lines, but the tighter the Germans took control of the ghettos, the worse the conditions got. So almost all of the smuggling that occurred was to get food, because that was the means of survival. And of course, for young children, the priority was, how do we feed young kids so they can survive? So every step was taken to protect the young children wherever possible.
I understand you had an older brother, and he had a pretty gruesome task.
Yeah, my older brother was 6 years older than I was. He passed away about 5 years ago. And since that time, I've kind of taken over his mantle of trying to communicate some of the things that happened during the Holocaust, and particularly to maybe the Gingold family and their willingness to try to survive. And apparently we were successful, one of the few successes. Anyway, my older brother, one of the things that happened in the ghetto is that there wasn't anything good about it. And when I say that, not only was it problematic in terms of starvation, but also disease, lack of medical care. There were some Jewish physicians that tried to do the best they could, but they suffered just as well as the other population in the ghetto. There was no medical care of any kind, basically. So the conditions were pretty bad. And let me just give you an example. When people died, one of the things that if they died indoors, all of the clothes would be removed from those people, because using the clothes was a way to barter for food. So what they would do is remove the clothes of the dead individuals and take those individuals and put them out on the sidewalks or streets. So basically, dead people were either leaning against buildings or were on the streets. And one of the tasks that happened was to pick up those dead corpses and put them on wagons. And the thing, one of the roles my older brother had, even though he was relatively young, he was one of the corpse picker-upper, load on wagons, and then they would pull the wagons out of the ghetto. And this was routine every day.
The number of people. Six or 7 years old, or 7 years old at this time.
That's correct.
Wow.
If he would have been much older, he would have been in slave labor. So he was also a very gutsy youngster, and he also got involved in helping build tunnels. And again, I have to give a lot of credit to my father, who was a hyperactive adult, I think, but pretty energetic and pretty bright, I think, where he was one of the leaders of some of the tunneling activities that was done all in secret and late at night after he and my uncle and my aunt came back from the slave labor. And usually their work schedule was about 14 hours a day on slave labor, and usually outside the camp working for the Nazi military-industrial complex at that time. I don't know what they did, but that was their most of the roles of people that were healthy enough and could hang in there for a bit.
So that actually gets us to how your family did escape the Warsaw Ghetto, one of the few
that
managed.
I told you the first time we tried unsuccessfully. The second attempt was a little different. And again, going back to my father, he and some others, kind of in secret, were able to get a set of families together. And the attempt was made to go through under the Warsaw sewer system. Now, just to mention, Warsaw was a very advanced city. It was one of the cultural capitals of the world at that time. So anyway, their effort with other families was to go into the sewers. And again, there was ongoing effort to build tunnels, not only between buildings, but outside the walls. And one of the things I should mention is shortly after the ghetto was set up, the Germans had a brick wall built around the ghetto with barbed wire and shards of glass on top, so no one could escape.
It really was a prison.
It was a prison. And just as a point of information, once a ghetto was set up, approximately 7,000 to 10,000 people a day died in the ghetto, either through starvation, medical issues, being abused in labor, and so on. I don't want to get into the gory stuff here, but nonetheless, that was a way of life or trying to survive kind of thing. So the second effort was these families, the leadership of those families met in secret. They would never share information with their family members because once they got caught, whatever punishment they received, the family members would receive. And it was usually where they got killed. It wasn't anything else. The options were pretty clear.
Yeah.
So anyway, that second attempt was through the sewers. And unfortunately, someone didn't close the sewer lid. And the Germans noticed that. So they immediately started firing into the sewers with machine guns. And a good portion of those families didn't make it back.
So that was the Gingold family's second escape attempt. There was a third. It would be successful, but it would not be easy. And we're going to hear more about that after a short break. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. As we mark International Holocaust Remembrance Day tomorrow, we're listening back to my conversation with Bill Gingold, a Holocaust survivor born in the Warsaw Ghetto. We originally spoke with Dr. Gingold back in September, around the time PBS was airing a multi-night documentary examining America's role in the Holocaust. Although it happened in Europe, filmmakers Ken Burns, Lynn Novick, and Sarah Botstein said their film shows how anti-immigrant sentiment slammed the door shut on helping Jewish people trying to escape the atrocities. One of the families that was turned down was a name that's familiar to many, as filmmaker Sarah Botstein told CBS.
When we started to make the film, it came to our attention that Anne Frank's family had tried to get to America, a fact that I did not know.
And I don't think most people know that.
I don't think most Americans know that.
Anne Frank chronicled her life in hiding from the Nazis while living in a concealed room in Amsterdam. Later, she and her sisters were sent to a concentration camp where it's believed she died of disease. Her father, the only survivor in her family, later published her diary, which became known around the world. The Gingold family, from Poland, was one of the few Jewish families allowed to immigrate to America, but that came years after Germany surrendered. When we left off our story, the Gingolds had made a second unsuccessful attempt to escape the Warsaw Ghetto.
The third effort was a little bit different. One of the things that was fortunate is that there were cemeteries adjacent to the ghetto. And one of the fortunate parts of having the cemeteries is that the Nazi guards did not guard the cemeteries. So a lot of the efforts of tunneling was to tunnel to the cemeteries. So one of the roles, additional role that my dad and my brother Sam had was tunneling. And usually at night when my parents My uncle and aunt came back from their slave labor. They would spend 2-3 hours doing tunneling between buildings and hopefully under the wall, under the brick walls that enclosed the Warsaw Ghetto into the cemeteries.
And is that where you and your family in 1942 in January after, what is that, almost three years in Warsaw?
So on the third try was to go through the tunnels, through the cemeteries, and that's where we were somewhat successful in getting to the Russian front after a number of weeks of travel through the woods at night. And I have to share with you a little bit of travel log here, if I may.
Sure. Are you old enough at this point that you have memories of this journey?
Well, usually my memories, I'll come to that.
Okay.
Okay. Usually my memories kind of kick in when I was about 3 years of age. Before that, sure. I can't recall anything.
Yeah. No, who can?
You know, and I'm not sure how totally accurate my memory was at 3 or 4 years or 5 years of age or any age, come to think of
it. Fair enough. It's what we have, though, right?
Yeah. But anyway, on the third try, we were able to tunnel to the cemeteries, and that included my aunt and uncle and my parents and my older brother. With other families. We weren't just alone. There were hundreds of other families that did the same thing. Some were successful, some were not. And we were fortunate enough over a period of time to get to the Russian front. And at that time, the non-aggression treaty was broken. So the Russians were at war with the Germans, which was fortunate for all of the people fleeing the Warsaw Ghetto and Poland itself to get to the Russian border.
Better to have the Russians not cooperating with the Germans.
Yeah. So we were basically in the hands of the Russian military, and they put us on trucks like they did before, except these were Russian trucks rather than German trucks. And they moved those trucks to basically railroads. And we were put into railroad cars, which were a lot more comfortable than the German railroad cars. They had padding, they had straw, they had some heat, they provided food. And one of the things I remember, and this is where I was about 3 years of age, a couple of memories come back, is that the Russians also had weapons, but they never pointed the weapon at any people. They always pointed the weapon down on the ground. Mm. The Germans never pointed their weapon on the ground. They always pointed them at the people.
And you remember that?
And
that,
I remember the pointing of the weapon.
Yeah.
And the reason I remember that is when we were on this train, we found out that we were going to Siberia, to the lumber camps in Siberia, which was part of the war effort to provide lumber and whatever they needed for the Russian front. And the train would stop periodically so people could get off the boxcars and go to the bathrooms. And that was my other recollection, other than the soldiers never pointing the weapon at you, was the bleakness of all the snow of Siberia.
Yeah.
And the cold that we experienced. So I learned a little bit about ice and snow, but we were little kids, so it was kind of fun because we could run around and they provided food for the people And they put them back in the boxcars, and up they went to Siberia, northern Siberia, to the lumber camps there. So I remember a little bit of our travels in terms of the boxcars. I remember the vastness of the snow. That never escapes me. And at that juncture, when we got onto the trains, we were separated from my aunt and uncle. Mm. So we didn't know where they were or where they went. We later learned, once we wound up being located in displaced persons, and I can come back to that, that they emigrated to Israel.
Mm.
But we don't know exactly when. But anyway, so we were basically with hundreds of other families moved to these lumber camps. And to the kids, it was fun. We were in barracks. It had heat in it, a lot of firewood. Kids didn't go to school or anything. We were well-fed. We were dressed well. Actually have a photograph of me and my brother, and we look like we're in great shape. So, you know, basically he was 9, about almost 10, and I was a little over 3 at that time. And basically the older kids, again, it's Siberia. It was pretty much in the winter, just as a namesake. Siberia has one warm month. 11 months out of the year, it's below freezing.
Wow.
Okay. And snowdrifts were 12 to 16 feet high, so they covered almost everything except the digging out to get to the lumber mills for the parents. And anybody that was able to work, worked, adults, and the older kids supervised the little kids. So my brother became my teacher, basically. And that's another memory that I have, is he would get sawdust with sticks, and he would put the sawdust on the floor, on the barracks floor, and just like an etching sketch, he would make numerals, signs, etc., to try to teach me figures, numbers, letters, etc. He was also a pretty bright young fellow, with a lot of lots of experiences in real life. So he was able to adapt things even at the young age of 9, 10, to the environment. And when the weather got a little better outside, all the kids went outside and had a hell of a good time because they could play. And they used sticks for swords, they threw snowballs, just like any array of kids. To them, it was wonderful. They were well-fed. They saw their parents at night because the parents worked anywhere from 12 to 14 hours a day. And one of the things that I learned as a young adult, because I always was kind of curious about my mother, because she didn't have any fingerprints. One of the things I learned is she worked on certain parts of the lumber mill where she had to use her fingers, and they all rubbed off.
Oh, my gosh.
And they never grew back in form of regular fingerprints. So, you know, you kind of learn different things as an adult from your parents, if they're willing to talk about it.
Yeah.
Most of the time, they weren't willing to do that.
Well, and maybe we can come back to that. Just
sure.
For the sake of time, may we skip VE Day, Germany's surrender to Allied forces. You mentioned earlier that your family was in a displaced persons camp in Berlin in 1946.
Yeah,
what was that like?
Yeah, well, once we were let go from the lumber camps, the Russians gave us papers where we could travel through Russia. And one of the things that most Jews did is try to go back to their own home countries to see if they could find family. It took us a while, and we couldn't find anybody that survived. And so one of the rumor mills was, as we were traveling for months going west, that if you can get to the to Berlin, which was divided between the, I think, England, France, Russia, and the United States.
Yeah, the four sectors.
If you can get into the American sector, there were organizations that might help refugees. So the target was to get to Berlin, and it took quite a few months to get there. A lot of trials and tribulations, and I don't think we have enough time here. And I remember quite a few of those. But anyway, we got to Berlin, and we were able to get to the American sector. We were in Berlin a very short time. We were housed in some apartment complexes that weren't bombed out. And basically, Berlin was kind of a tertiary relocation hub where, you know, if you got to Berlin, you got connected with whatever organizations you were able to connect, they would try to get you to another safe place. And most of these safe places for Jewish people were displaced persons camps. They were all over Germany, mostly a limited few in Poland, but most of them were in Germany. And we were sent to a DP camp called Fehrenwald. There were about 20-some DP camps in Germany. Fehrenwald was one of the larger ones. At the peak, I think it probably had a population of over 5,000. So it was really kind of a self-contained community, if you will, supervised by the American military forces that were enclosed, but not by anything serious in terms of barbed wire or anything like that. And people could go outside of the these camps and interact with the farming community, because they were usually in farming areas. They set up schools. Unfortunately, and I don't know the circumstances, I was not going to school. Neither was my brother. Hmm. So basically, neither one of us had an education. And I was just having a heck of a time being a kid without any responsibilities and, you know, kind of following my parents around whenever I could. So to me, it was relatively a fun experience. The things that I learned were pretty much life experiences rather than formal education, because when we emigrated to the United States, I was a young teenager and I never went to school. So I had to learn the ABCs in, I guess you call it, junior high or middle school at that time.
Let me take a moment to remind listeners this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Holocaust survivor Bill Gingold. More on starting from scratch in America at age 12 when we return. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. For our entire program today, we're listening to the Holocaust survival story of the Gingold family, as told by Bill, who was born in Nazi-occupied Poland and spent the first 3 years of his life in the Warsaw Ghetto. We're revisiting this conversation in advance of International Holocaust Remembrance Day, which is tomorrow, January 27th. We originally spoke with Bill last September, leading up to the premiere of a PBS documentary, The U.S. and the Holocaust. As we heard before the break, the Gingold family escaped to Russia and spent the rest of the war in a Siberian logging camp. After the war, they returned to Europe and spent another 6 years in a camp for displaced persons. When they could finally emigrate, they ended up in America. But Bill Gingold says that was by chance.
One of the things that was fortunate for us is that the agencies that worked with us in Berlin and in Fehrenwald gave us a choice, or gave my parents a choice. They could either go to Argentina, Israel, or United States. And for some pot luck, they decided on the United States, not being aware of any of those three places.
Well, that is such an interesting point, because you mentioned your family had heard these rumors. If they can get to the American sector in Berlin right after the war, they can get to the U.S. 6 years go by. And one of the reasons we're talking is because of this new PBS documentary series that looks at America's role in the Holocaust and not doing enough to be a shelter for people who are trying to escape it before and after. Was your family frustrated by the fact that it took 6 years to move on?
Well, I'm sure they were. They didn't express it to their two kids, per se, because they didn't talk very much about the situation in the war.
Well, so I guess maybe that pre-answers my next question, which was if you or anyone in your family was angry or had any resentment about the delay in the U.S. policy at the time.
No, not that I could sense from them. It was part of life. We learned how to wait, how to respond, to take advantage of what you could take advantage of, and to hold off on things that could be delayed. I think those were skills that were learned during these times. And I guess I would regard them at this point in time as pretty damn good skills.
Yes. So your family settles in Milwaukee.
Okay.
You're 11 years old. You don't speak English, as I understand it. And
yeah. Well,
you're starting
12.
Or 12. Okay.
Yeah.
And you're starting new in school. What was the reception you got in America? How did your neighbors react?
Well, like I said, we were somewhat comforted by a couple of social service agencies that tried to help us out. And the reason we were sent to Milwaukee, and that again was potluck, is that I looked at the skill levels of my parents. They were both unskilled laborers. My dad went, I think, to the fourth grade in education. My mom never went to school. Each could speak five languages, but that was beside the point, but it's language of survival. And so based on the economics that were occurring at that time, Milwaukee was very good for employment of unskilled labor. They had a lot of manufacturing, foundries, etc. My dad wound up working in a steel mill pretty much all his life in the United States. My mom wound up working in a bakery pretty much all of her life in the United States. We were again very fortunate because we came to the States during the summer. So the social service agencies that worked with us provided a tutor for my brother and me. And that helped a little bit because it was during the summer before school started. So I learned a little bit about English. Very little, come to think of it. One of my greatest exposure to English is that in Milwaukee at that time, they had the movie theaters in downtown. And my mom would give me some money, pack me a lunch, and I would take the bus. And the movie houses opened around, I think, 11 o'clock in the morning. And they recycled the film until they closed late at night. So I would basically take a bus, go to the movie, have a lunch, and sit there for 5-6 hours watching American movies. And most of the movies I watched were cowboy movies. And that's where a little bit of irony comes in. At that time, the movies that I watched, Hop Along Cassidy was king of the cowboys. And his Hollywood name was William Boyd. So when I turned 18, I applied for American citizenship. And appeared in front of the judge. And he couldn't pronounce my Hebrew name, which was Baruch.
Baruch.
Baruch, which means bless you. He couldn't pronounce the name, so he said, would you like an American name? And a flash came to me, King of the Cowboys, William Boyd. William was it. That's how I became known as Bill Gingold.
Did your family adopt your cowboy name?
Yes, they did.
They did.
They didn't have any choice because it was my choice for the name because I was applying on my own as a citizen.
How do you go from a student who basically, as you told it, was starting almost from scratch in what we would say junior high school, don't know English, to medical school and a career as a physician?
Well, I was fortunate. We lived in the ghetto of Milwaukee. We were one of the few white families in the black ghetto of Milwaukee. And I was very fortunate that I made some very good friends that were kind of both my guardians, my protectors, and also somewhat my educators, where I was able to not only learn to be streetwise, but also kind of learn different kinds of attitudes about people. I had two friends, both of them black. One was a squirrely little guy who could just hyperactive as heck. And everything he did was fast motion, couldn't stop, but very bright, very bright. And then a big, tall guy by the name of Ben. Ken was a squirrely guy, Ben was a big guy. They were kind of my buddies. They tried to teach me words, etc. Some maybe not appropriate. But anyway, I learned a lot from them.
That's important, too.
We lost track of each other. I tried to communicate with them once we were, you know, kind of junior seniors in high school, and we kind of lost track of each other. And then I found out once I started college that Big Ben wound up going to prison. I don't know for what or for any length of time. And Kenny wound up going to Marquette University, got a degree in engineering, was on the Olympic track team, and then followed up with a master's in engineering. But here, just kind of separate worlds. In terms of what happened. So we kind of lost track of each other once we got to college. But anyway, all of the experiences I've had, I always regard as very positive, always learning. And that was, I guess, my motto with my parents, even though they weren't very proficient in English. They knew a lot of languages. I try to emulate them a little bit.
So as we come to the end of our time together, I understand you waited until you were in your 80s to really talk about you and your family's experiences during the Holocaust. Why is that?
I think I almost took the same posture as my parents. And the reason I wound up in my late 70s, early 80s, my brother passed away. He was the last one of our family. And I felt an obligation to continue what he was doing.
To honor their memories.
Yes.
Why is it important? The saying is never forget. Why is that important?
People have short-term memories. They recall mostly pleasant things, which is great. Otherwise, we probably have a preponderance of depressed people walking around, and we still have a lot of depressed people. I think education is so critical that I don't think people should forget history, whether it's from their own culture, their own faith, ethnic group, etc. It plays a very important part in their continuation. And one of the things I learned over the years is how important education is in one's personal life. One of the things I learned from my parents, especially, is that no one can take away your education. They can take away your food, your house, your clothes, but things that you learn, if you hang in there, they can't take away. So, as part of that, once my older brother passed, and I had some encouragement from one of the local people, Brian Kahn, who is director of the Holocaust Education Center for the CU Jewish Federation. He was after me for a couple of years to maybe share some experiences. And I said, yeah, I'll do that, primarily with school kids, because that's where the action needs to be for education. The earlier, the better. If we can educate them, even with a small impact, even if it's 1 out of 100, that can pick up some positive attitudes and move it along into the future, I think it's positive for our society. So that's when I took on the mantle of my brother and our family a little bit.
As you look around today, do you see people forgetting the lessons of the Holocaust?
Yeah, it's very scary. Look what happened in the marches that we had not too long ago, with hundreds of far right white folks marching with torches, repeating the same crap, pardon my language, that was done in the early 30s until the Nazis took over Germany. Same stuff. That's frightening.
Well, Dr. William Gingold, I want to thank you so much for sharing your time and your story with us today.
It was my pleasure.
Bill Gingold is a retired family physician who lives in Urbana, Illinois. He, along with his brother, mother, and father, escaped the Nazi Holocaust in World War II. We've been listening back to his story to mark tomorrow's International Holocaust Remembrance Day. And that's all the time we have for our program this week. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our interns are Owen Henderson and Anaya Jones. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again next week.